Chapter 34. Fulvia, with an air of constraint, held out her hand to Odo. I shall see you soon again, he whispered, and Sister Mary, as though as he had guessed his words, cried out, I think your excellency may count on a recurrence of the seizure 2 days hence at the same hour. 3.5. With this Odo was forced to be content, and he passed the intervening time in devising the means of Fulvia's rescue. He was resolved to let no rashness or negligence hinder the attempt, and to prove, by the discretion of his course, that he was no longer the light fool who had once hazarded her safety. He went about his preparations as one that had no private stake in the venture, but he was therefore the more punctilious to show himself worthy of her trust, and sensible of the charge it laid upon him. At their next meeting he found her in the same open and friendly mood, and she listened gratefully as he set forth his plan. This was that she should first write to a doctor of the university in Geneva, who had been her father's friend, stating her plight and asking if he could help her to a living, should she contrive to reach Geneva. Pending the reply, Odo was to plan the stages of the journey in such fashion that she might count on concealment in case of pursuit, and she was not to attempt her escape till these details were decided. Fulvia was the more ready to acquiesce in this postponement as she did not wish to involve Sister Mary in her adventure, but hoped to escape unassisted during an entertainment which was to take place in the convent on the feast of Saint Michael, some 6 weeks later. To Odo the delay was still more welcome, for it gave him what he must needs regard as his last opportunity of being in the girl's company. She had accepted his companionship on the journey with a readiness in which he saw only the magnanimity of pardon, but in Geneva they must part, and what hope had he of seeing her again? The first smart of vanity allayed, he was glad she chose to treat him as a friend. It was in this character that he could best prove his disinterestedness, his resolve to make amends for the past. And in this character only, as he now felt, would it be possible for him to part from her. On his second visit he ventured to discharge his mind of its heaviest burden, by inquiring what had befallen her and her father, after he had lost trace of them at Vercelli. She told him quite simply that, failing to meet him at the appointed place, they at once guessed that his plan had been winded by the abbate who traveled with him, and that after a few hours' delay her father had succeeded in securing a chaise which had taken them safely across the border. She went on to speak of the hardships they had suffered after reaching Milan. Even under a comparatively liberal government it was small advantage to be marked by the Holy Office, and though he received much kindness, and even material aid, from those of his way of thinking, Vivaldi was unable to obtain the professorship he had hoped for. From Milan they went to Pavia, but in this university, the most liberal in Italy, the chairs were so sought after that there was no hope of his receiving a charge worthy of his talents. Here, however, his spirit breathed its natural air, and reluctant to lose the privileges of such intercourse he decided to accept the post of librarian to an eccentric nobleman of the town. If his pay was modest, his duties left him leisure for the work which was his chief concern, for his patron, who had houses in Milan and Brescia, came seldom to Pavia, and Fulvia and her father had the vast palace to themselves. They lodged in a corner adjoining the library, spending their days in studious seclusion, their evenings in conversation with some of the first scholars of Europe. The learned botanists Scopoli, Spallanzani, Volta, and Father Fontana, the famous mathematician. In such surroundings Vivaldi might have pursued his task contentedly enough, but for the thought of Fulvia's future. This, his daughter said, continually preyed on him, driving him to labors beyond his strength, for he hoped by the publication of his book to make good, at least in part, the loss of the small property which the Sardinian government had confiscated. All her entreaties could not dissuade him from overexertion, and in addition to his regular duties he took on himself, as she afterward learned, the tedious work of revising proofs and copying manuscripts for the professors. This drudgery, combined with severe intellectual effort, exceeded his flagging powers, and the book was hardly completed when his patron, apprised of its contents, abruptly removed him from his post. From that day Vivaldi sank in health, but he ended as became a sage, content to have discharged the task for which he had given up home and substance, and dying with the great Stoic's words upon his lips. Lex non pena mors. Vivaldi's friends in Milan came generously to Fulvia's aid, and she would gladly have remained among them, but after the loss of her small inheritance, and of her father's manuscript, she was without means of repaying their kindness, and nothing remained but to turn to her own kin. As Odo sat in the quiet cell, listening to her story, and hearing again the great names his youth had reverenced, he felt himself an exile returning to his own, mounting the familiar heights and breathing the air that was his birthright. Looking back from this recovered standpoint, he saw how far behind his early hopes had been left. Since his departure from Naples, there had been nothing to remind him of that vast noiseless labor of the spirit going on everywhere beneath the social surface. That baffled but undiscouraged endeavor in which he had once so impatiently claimed his share. Now every word of Fulvia smote the bones of some dead purpose, till his bosom seemed a very valley of Ezekiel. Her own trials had fanned her love of freedom, and the near hope of release lent an exultation to her words. Of bitterness, of resentment, she gave no sign, and he was awed by the same serenity of spirit which had struck him in the imprisoned doctor. But perhaps the strongest impression she produced was that of increasing his points of contact with life. His other sentimental ties had been a barrier between himself and the outer world, but the feeling which drew him to Fulvia had the effect of leveling the bounds of egoism, of letting into the circle of his nearest emotions that great tide of human longing and effort that had always faintly sounded on the shores of self. Perhaps it was her power of evoking this wider life that gave a sense of permanence, of security almost, to the stolen moments of their intercourse, lulling the lover's impatience of actual conditions with the sense of something that must survive the accidents of fortune. Only in some such way could he explain, in looking back, the completeness of each moment spent with her. He was conscious even at the time of a suspension of the emotional laws, a charmed surrender to the limitations of his fate. When he was away, his impatience reasserted itself, but her presence was like a soothing hand on his spirit, and he knew that his quiet hours with her would count among those intervals between the crises of life that flower in memory when the crises themselves have faded. It was natural that in the course of these visits she in turn should question him, and as his past rearranged itself beneath her scrutiny, he seemed once more to trace the thread of purpose on which its fragments hung. He told her of his connection with the liberals of Pianura, of the situation at court, and of the reason for his prolonged travels. As he talked, her eyes conveyed the exquisite sense of her complete comprehension. She saw, before he could justify himself, how the uncertainty of his future, and his inability to act, had cast him adrift upon a life of superficial enjoyment, and how his latent dissatisfaction with this life had inevitably resulted in self-distrust and vacillation. "You wait your hour," she said of him, and he seized on the phrase as a justification of his inactivity, and, when chance should offer, a spur to fresh endeavor. Her interest in the liberal cause had been intensified, and exalted by her father's death, his martyrdom, as she described it. Like most women possessed of an abstract idea, he had unconsciously personified the idea and made a religion of it, but it was a religion of charity and not of vindictiveness. I should like my father's death avenged by love and not by hate, she said. I would have it bring peace, not a sword. On one point only she remained, if not hostile yet unresponsive. This was when he spoke of the Crucis. Her manner hardened instantly, and he perceived that, though he dwelt on the Jesuit's tolerant view and cultivated tastes, she beheld only the priest, and not the man. as he had been eager to hear of Crescenti, whom she knew by name as a student of European repute, and to the praise of whose parochial charities she listened with outspoken sympathy. But the Jesuits stood for the Holy Office, and as he had suffered too deeply at the hands of the Holy Office, to regard with an open mind any who might be supposed to represent its principles. It was impossible for Odo to make her understand how distinctly, in de Crucis's case, the man predominated over the order, and conscious of the painfulness of the subject, he gave up the attempt to interest her in his friend. Three or four times he was permitted to visit her in her cell. After that they met almost daily in the parlor, where, about the hour of benediction, they could talk almost as privately under cover of the general chatter. In due time Fulvia received an answer from the Calvinist professor, who assured her of a welcome in Geneva and shelter under his roof. Odo, meanwhile, had perfected the plan of their journey. But as Michaelmas approached he began to fear Cantapresto's observation. He now bitterly regretted that he had not held to his purpose of sending the soprano back to Pianura, but to do so at this point would be to challenge observation, and he resolved instead on dispatching him to Monte Loro with a letter to the old Duke. As the way to Geneva lay in the opposite direction, this would at least give the fugitives a 3 days' lead, and they had little cause to fear pursuit from any other quarter. The convent indeed might raise a hue and cry, but the nuns of Santa Chiara had lately given the devout so much cause for scandal that the abbess would probably be disposed to hush up any fresh delinquency. The time too was well chosen, for the sisters had prevailed on the Reverend Mother to celebrate the saint's day by a masked ball, and the whole convent was engrossed in the invention of whimsical disguises. The nuns indeed were not to take part in the ball, but a number of them were to appear in an allegorical entertainment with which the evening was to open. The new papal nuncio, who was lately arrived in Venice, had promised to be present, and as he was known to be a man of pleasure there was scarce a sister in the convent but had an eye to his conquest. These circumstances gave to Fulvia's plans the shelter of indifference. For in the delightful effort of surpassing the other nuns, even Mary of the Crucifix lost interest in her friend's affairs. Odo, to preserve the secrecy of his designs, had been obliged to keep up a pretense of his former habits, showing himself abroad with Pier Volant and Castel Ravinato, and frequenting the procuratessa's routs and card parties. This lady, though lately returned to the Brenta, had announced her intention of coming to Venice for the ball at Santa Chiara, and Pier Volant was mightily preoccupied with the entertainment, at which he purposed his mistress should outshine all her companions. The evening came at last, and Odo found himself entering the gates of Santa Chiara with a throng of merrymakers. The convent was noted for its splendid hospitality, and unwonted preparations had been made to honor the saint. The brightly illuminated bridge leading to the square of Santa Chiara was decked with a colonnade of pasteboard and stiffened linen cunningly painted, and a classical portico masked the entrance gate. A flourish of trumpets and hautboys, and the firing of miniature cannon, greeted the arrival of the guests, who were escorted to the parlor, which was hung with tapestries and glowing with lights like a lady chapel. Here they were received by the abbess, who, on the arrival of the nuncia, led the way to the garden, where a stage had been erected. The nuns who were not to take part in the play had been seated directly under the stage, divided from the rest of the company by a low screen of foliage. Ranged beneath the footlights, which shone on their bare shoulders and white gowns, and on the gauze veils replacing their monastic coifs, they seemed a choir of pagan virgins grouped in the proscenium of an antique theater. Everything indeed combined to produce the impression of some classic festival. The setting of motionless foliage, the mild autumnal sky in which the stars hung near and vivid, and the foreground thronged with a motley company lit by the shifting brightness of torches. as Odo, in mask and travesty, stood observing the fantastically dressed audience, the pasteboard theater adorned with statuary, and the nuns flitting across the stage, his imagination, strung to the highest pitch by his own impending venture, was thrilled by the contrast between the outward appearance of the scene and its underlying reality. From where he stood, he looked directly at the abbess, who was seated with the nuncia and his suite under the tall crucifix in the center of the garden. As if to emphasize the irony of the situation, the torch fixed behind this noble group cast an enlarged shadow of the cross over the abbess's white gown, and the splendid robes of her companions, who, though they wore the mask, had not laid aside their clerical dress. To Odo, the juxtaposition had the effect of some supernatural warning, the shadow of the divine wrath projected on its heedless ministers. An impression heightened by the fact that, just opposite the cross, a lively figure of Pan, surmounting the pediment of the theater, seemed to fling defiance at the Galilean intruder. The nuns, like the rest of the company, were unmasked, and it had been agreed between Odo and Fulvia that the latter should wear a wreath of myrtle above her veil. As almost all her companions had chosen brightly colored flowers, this dark green chaplet was easily distinguished among the clustered heads beneath the stage, and Odo had no doubt of being able to rejoin Fulvia in the moment of dispersal that should follow the conclusion of the play. He knew that the sisters were to precede their guests, and be locked behind the grate before the ball began. But as they passed through the garden and cloisters, the barrier between nuns and visitors would probably not be too strictly maintained. As he had foreseen, the company, attracted by the graceful procession, pressed forward regardless of the assistant mistress's protests, and the shadowy arcades were full of laughter and whispered snatches of talk as the white flock was driven back to its fold. Odo had withdrawn to the darkest angle of the cloister, close to a door leading to the pharmacy. It was here that Fulvia had told him to wait, and though he had lost sight of her when the audience rose, he stood confidently watching for the reappearance of the myrtle wreath. Presently he saw it close at hand, and just then the line of sisters flowed toward him, driven forward by a group of lively masqueraders, among whom he seemed to recognize Pierre Volant's voice and figure. Nothing could have been more opportune, for the pressure swept the wearer of the myrtle wreath almost into his arms, and as the intruders were dispersed, and the nuns laughingly reformed their lines, her hand lingered in his and he felt himself drawn toward the door. It yielded to her touch and Odo followed her down a dark passageway to the empty room, where rows of old Faenza jars and quaintly shaped flagons glimmered in the dusk. Beyond the pharmacy was another door, the key of which hung on the wall with the portress's hood and cloak. Without a word, the girl wrapped herself in the cloak and, fitting the key to the lock, softly opened the door. All this was done with a rapidity and assurance for which Odo was unprepared. But, reflecting that Fulvia's whole future hung on the promptness with which each detail of her plan was executed, he concluded that her natural force of character enabled her to assume an ease she could hardly feel. The door opened on the kitchen garden, and brushing the lavender edges with her flying skirts, she sped on ahead of Odo to the postern which the nuns were accustomed to use for their nocturnal escapades. Only the thickness of an oaken gate stood between Fulvia and the outer world. To her, the opening of the gate meant the first step toward freedom, but to Odo, the passing from their enchanted weeks of fellowship to the inner loneliness of his former life. He hung back silent while she drew the bolt. A moment later they had crossed the threshold, and his gondola was slipping toward them out of the shadow of the wall. Fulvia sprang on board, and he followed her under the fells. The warm darkness enclosing them stirred impulses which their daily intercourse had subdued, and in the sense of her nearness he lost sight of the conditions which had brought them together. The feeling seemed to communicate itself. For as the gondola rounded the angle of the convent wall, and swung out on the open, she drooped toward him with the turn of the boat, and their lips met under the loosened masks. At the same instant, the light of the Virgin's shrine in the corner of the convent wall fell through the window of the fells on the face lifted to Odo's, and he found himself suddenly confronted by the tender eyes and malicious smile of Sister Mary of the Crucifix. "By Diana," she cried as he started back, "I did but claim my pay in advance, nor do I think that, when she knows all, Sister Veronica will grudge me my reward." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.